You are listening to a free podcast of The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. To support the show and receive nearly an hour extra material daily, become a member today at majority.fm. Resistance is futile.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. It's time to look in the mirror, America. Do you like what you see?
I keep referring to Obama as the magic Negro.
Do you like what you see now?
Well, suck on this.
It's just a mirror, America.
Shared sacrifice by everybody.
What could it do to you except reflect your image?
I did nothing wrong at the Minneapolis airport.
The Majority Report.
Far more credible to me than PBS.
And Frontline.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
If I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Thursday, July 11th, 2013. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. On the program today, Sarah Slaman. We played the audio of her confronting Texas state legislators on Wednesday. She did that on Tuesday. We played it on Wednesday. Fighting back against the restrictions the Texas state legislature are en route to impose on a woman's constitutional right for abortion services. She also had a couple of things to say about the rest of the agenda for the Republicans in the Texas State House. She will be joining us live in a moment. Also on the program today, an interview I did at Netroots Nation with Dan Cantor of the Working Families Party, specifically about the legislation they are pushing nationally, but not the least of which in the state of Oregon, which passed earlier this week, called Pay It Forward, Pay It Back, a novel and, by all accounts, great policy on providing funds for college on a day when the Senate has struck a deal on student loans, a really horrible deal, in my estimation, which could raise student loan rates significantly over the next 5-10 years. Also on the program today, the nuclear option for filibuster reform on the table, says Harry Reid just moments ago on the floor of the Senate. The Bradley Manning trial continues. A Harvard law professor speaking on the question as to whether or not WikiLeaks is a journalistic outfit. And meanwhile, Republicans gather in a room to talk about how much they dislike brown people and come out and announce they're going to do everything in their power to destroy any type of immigration reform. And finally, as ENDA, the Employee Non-Discrimination Act, passes the HELP Committee in the Senate I don't know if that legislation is going to go anywhere. It's been, we've had it now for almost 20 years attempting to pass the really crazy radical idea that as an employer, you cannot discriminate against someone because they are gay. And a story of a Pennsylvania man, I believe he was 65 years old, who has adopted his 73-year-old partner because you're not allowed to get the same rights as straight people if you are gay in Pennsylvania. All that and more on today's program. We're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we'll be talking to Sarah Slaman. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report. We played the 3 minutes of her testimony yesterday on this program, and it is a pleasure to be speaking to her in person. Sarah Slaman, welcome to the program.
Hi, Sam. Thanks so much for having me.
So, Sarah, this your testimony the other day in front of the... and I'm not sure exactly what the specific committee was. You'll tell us.
It's Health and Human Services Committee.
Health and Human Services Committee in the Texas Senate was really impressive. And I want to talk about first what you got up to the mic. You said, I had a prepared statement, but I've been here all day, and you seemed quite... You basically seem just fed up with what you heard. Just tell us what your day was like. What did you hear? What time did you get to the Senate?
I left a relative's house about 90 miles outside of Austin at 5:30 a.m. so I could get to the Capitol a little before 7 to help narrow Texas out with some volunteer check-in stuff. I got in line to register for oral testimony around 9 a.m. I got out of that line at 10:30 a.m. and then waited in an auditorium watching testimony throughout the day until I was eventually called into a room to testify at 11:15 p.m. So it was
wow.
A very long day.
And what did you hear over the course of that nearly 12 hours?
I heard a lot of what I'd been hearing since I originally went to testify on June 20th. You know, it doesn't matter how much expert medical testimony we bring. It doesn't matter how many State Department officials who have the real facts about abortion in Texas came forward. The other side just got to constantly barrage us with pseudoscience and a lot of misogynistic insults, just person after person going up referencing murder, killing, promiscuity, being selfish. You know, all that talk about babies as punishment for bad girls, for fallen women. And when they got to a testimony of a woman who had to talk about a medically necessary abortion of a child who would be born with spina bifida, I was really moved because this woman and her husband had spent a lot of their savings on in vitro to get pregnant with that child in the first place. It was devastating. And the anti-choicer who testified after was sitting right next to her and took an opportunity to say, I know two people who have adopted children with spina bifida. And not a word. It was so pointed, and everyone reacted in person and on social media with, did she just really say that? That was awful. How horrendous. But not a word from a person on the committee, and certainly not from committee chairwoman Senator Jane Nelson. And that woman who had had the abortion had testified through furious, painful tears, and she remained silent and didn't, you know, strike out. I don't know what I would have done. So at that point, I scrapped my speech and just began to research every Republican on the committee.
And so what were you sitting there on? Did you have your computer with you? Is that it?
I had my iPhone. I did that from a smartphone. You got a smartphone, you can get them.
And so now your testimony was not complete. at one point, there was, as far as I could count, at least two or maybe three state troopers, I guess, who basically picked you up and pulled you out of there.
Yeah, it ended up being five eventually, but two pulled me out with a third coming behind them. Yeah.
And where did they did they just escort you out of the building? What happened?
They took me out, and they were kind of like leading me down this kind of dead-end hallway, and I was like, oh, okay, I'm going to get charged with something now. And their sergeant was coming. So I think they were getting ready to, like, officially, you know, do something with me. But thankfully, due to the wonder of, you know, all the proceedings being shown on the rooms in the Capitol and social media, a bunch of people rushed upstairs and just, like, refused to isolate me with the police and stayed until I made it clear that you're going to go get my bag out of that room and I'm going to drive out of this Capitol a free person because I haven't broken the law.
And I want to get to what your testimony would have been. We're going to give you the full time to say it. But are you planning to take any action? I mean, is there any legal recourse for your being shut down ostensibly because you were criticizing the legitimacy of an optometrist, basically functioning in her words as some type of expert on reproductive care?
Yeah, we looked into the House and Senate chamber rules. I did not break any rule there. People all throughout the day had spoken in the tone I'd spoken, just on the other side, and had been, you know, unfactual and committed, like, you know, character defamation. I literally just pointed out that Donna Campbell is a practicing ophthalmologist and hasn't used her emergency licensing in a long time. That's all I pointed out. So a lot of people have been talking about First Amendment rights violations, but in my opinion, I mean, I don't know these days, you know, in a post-9/11 America, I don't know how good of a chance I would have with a case like that. If anyone thinks I'm wrong about that, feel free to reach out to me at Victorian Prude on Twitter and I'll listen, but I actually don't have a lot of hope in a First Amendment case on that.
Right. All right. So tell us, what did you originally plan to say?
Well, remember that I only had 2 minutes. Mm-hmm. So I had compiled basic facts about each member of the committee that was there and the author of the bill, Glenn Hagar. And I was going to say, like, spit out a fact and then, like, give, you know, like, a judgment of it. So, like, in Glenn Hagar's defense, it was going to be that, like, 80% of children in one of his district schools depend on the free lunch program. He doesn't have time to make sure and find out why these children have to live in poverty, but he does have time to regulate, you know, women's bodies and talk about the unborn and stuff like that. That was an example of how I was going to go down the line towards Senator Taylor, to Senator Schwartner, and to Senator Nelson herself.
And just give us just for those people who and when we've certainly talked about the legislation, but talk to us about the legislation that, I mean, you know, by all accounts at this point, it looks like it's going to end up passing. But who knows? But what is it that they're trying to push down there?
So what they're trying to do is bring up an unconstitutional challenge about viability. The Supreme Court has ruled that viability is at 24 weeks. They're trying to enforce this bad standard, non-substantiated idea of fetal pain before 20 weeks as a reason to do that. They can't come up with a study in any medical journal that's peer-reviewed. They can come up with plenty of community-reviewed for laymen out there. Community-reviewed means your friends can write the paper. It's not peer-reviewed. And they're trying to use that to challenge at, you know, the Supreme Court level, which is a complete waste of Texas money and time. That will fail the court level like everyone else's challenge does. This is also a drive to enrich the Perry family. Milla Perry Jones, older sister of Governor Perry, is the head lobbyist for Ambulatory Surgical Alliance and doctor-owned hospitals in Texas. All hospitals that didn't already meet the standards would be required to upgrade to ambulatory surgical standards, which are actually less regulated than the already current abortion providers.
So, right now, and I want to make something. I want to just explain what this these standards are. Is basically, it's just saying that they need to have the functions essentially of emergency care, I guess, right? I mean,
absolutely, yeah. Most abortions don't require surgical intervention, so it's you know, arduous that way. Why do you need a surgical center to provide the RU486 pill? You don't. And then second of all, there's all kinds of just sweet spots in there for the hospital construction industry. You need extra janitor's closet. You need a men's locker room. Sam, how many abortion clinics do you think need more men's locker room in Texas?
Right.
So it's, you know, it's a lot of giveaways. It's a lot, and most surprisingly, in a political sense, this shows how brazen they are. This is huge government intervention. This is huge mandates, and you know, of upgrades for private businesses with no appropriation of funds. It's just backwards, pretty much in every instance you can think.
And there's a whole raft of surgical procedures that are performed in doctor's offices, essentially, that don't require
vasectomies. Vasectomies, right?
Yeah.
There's no regulations for vasectomies like that, or like really any other procedure like that in the state of Texas. It all comes back to women's reproductive choice.
And, you know, you also, during the course of the testimony, spoke about essentially the other things that you felt that the Texas state legislature was dropping the ball on. Give me a sense of what your background has been. I mean, I know you're obviously very politically active, but just give us a sense of what you've been up to. And also just give us a sense of your background.
Well, I graduated from the University of Houston in 2008 with a degree in political science. But I feel like I need to make this point really clear. You get Sarah Slamans by making sure your daughters have access to speech and debate programs. You get Sarah Slamans by making sure that your public school districts have to maintain their constitutional law programs. I had access to incredible programs in Texas public school that there's just no longer any funding for. And if we don't teach our young people to be civic and how to make their points clear, they'll resort to guns or they'll resort to apathy, okay? So that was a huge part of my development as a person who could, you know, be politicized and politicize others. Like many people in my generation, you know, I'm 28 years old, the Iraq War seriously radicalized me. When I was 17 years old, I got a very fresh idea of just how deceptive and forceful a government could be when the entire world was against it. So for the past 10 or 11 years, I've been involved, you know, in anything from wage theft, feminist issues, trying as hard as I can to resuscitate a Democratic Party in Texas before I even gave up on that. I mean, it's been across the board wherever I thought I could help in Texas at a grassroots level.
And you also, during your testimony, you thanked the Texas state legislature for being so out front with what you perceived their agenda has been all along. Just to talk about that a little bit and what you think the impact that has had on people who are not as politically engaged as you obviously have been.
Well, a big, big punch to the gut happened in 2011. And that's when Senator Dan Patrick from Houston passed this mandatory transvaginal ultrasound bill. Now, it wasn't just devastating effects for Texas. After we passed that law, seven other states have had it. Most recently, the governor of Wisconsin signed it in. Thankfully, they have a federal injunction.
Right.
But the mandatory transvaginal ultrasound was a clear, kind of a shining moment on their new pivot. So remember in the 90s, it was just nonstop talk about the unborn, 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 unborn. But at a constitutional level, they just kept getting smacked down. Now that they've switched to the women's health and the women's right to know, they can disguise it all as all this health care legislation. So when I said, you know, thanks for being willing to do it in the open, that's because after 2011 and we women realized how, you know, how this had just come out of nowhere and happened so fast while we were disorganized, we vowed that we had to work. And since 2011, there have been numerous grassroots activists and women's health organizations like NARO, Planned Parenthood, who have been working very diligently to bring attention to the harm that this legislation could do, not only in Texas, but how it spreads. Like, it's, you know, it's not a coincidence that this is all happening everywhere at the same time.
And I mean, give me a sense of, you know, it's interesting because, you know, when we called you for the show, you had you indicated to my producer, Michael, that you had heard us on Air America back in the day. And, you mm-hmm. know, my sense has always been that those progressive folks who are living in a red state have a are in many ways so much more activated because they are living with the implications.
We live it.
Yes, I mean, it's not a potential. You're going through it every day. Do you get the sense that in Texas, though? I mean, have you seen a level of awareness changing? I mean, obviously, Texas is one of those states because of demographics. Is considered to be turning sort of more purple
The cities are blue for all intents and purposes. You know, Dallas, Austin, and Houston for the past four cycles have occasionally or consistently gone blue. You know, Travis County's always been this blue dot in the sea of red. But, yes, you know, the Texas legislature, this is historic. They have never experienced a session like this or a second special session. They have never seen this level of participation in just common committee hearings. They've never, ever had a citizen's filibuster kill a bill the way we did on June 25th when, you know, there was 20 minutes left to go and the Democrats couldn't get out of the Senate, you know, with our skins intact. They've never experienced that. So while I don't know how much momentum it will take and how long it will take to really attack the structural problems for the minority party in Texas, I know for sure that participation has ramped up in a huge way.
Do you get the sense that that people who participation is ramped up? I mean, do you get the sense that this is sort of spreading to people who has it changed people's perspective? I guess what I'm getting at is, you know, how much of what is happening in Texas is a function of demographics, and how much of it is a function of people finally engaging, people who may have casually just voted or self-identified as conservative or Republican, and now they're just being repulsed at what's happening in terms of their rights?
A lot of what's happening is a breaking point for women. You know, we have a lot of great allies. But this has undeniably been driven by a lot of younger women and some older women in Texas. So, on one hand, you're right, it's demographics. It's young women who live in Austin, have the ability to get there, and, they're young. They depend on these clinics for low-cost care for a variety of things, not just abortion access. So, on one hand, it's that. As far as participation, that's where it's a long game. That's where, you know, to be completely honest, the Texas Democratic Party is crippled. It's anemic. And they have to, in my sense, move out of Austin. They have to get deeper into Harris County. They have to get deeper into Tarrant County. They have to get deeper into West Texas. There are younger people there, and there are demographics changing there, and they need to be reached out to and recognized. You can't do everything from Austin. Only 1 million people there. You know, Texas is more diverse than Austin. So that's the long game, but I think that, you know, people saying, wow, those Democrats aren't just going to shut up and take it there. That's going to help that long game.
And one of the things you mentioned in your testimony, too, was that you were leaving Texas. I want to ask you about, tell us why. And particularly, you know, in light of, you know, you're articulating sort of a political savvy about Texas that I would imagine is maybe not is pretty close to just about every anybody who's sort of professionally involved in politics in Texas. Why not stay there? Why move?
Well, the clearest point that I should make is, you know, that I didn't have the context to discuss in the hearing was the man I love that I've been with for the past 3 years was born and raised in New York. We're going back to his home. You know, we cannot afford to get pregnant in this state. The idea of, you know, no matter how hard we try, me getting pregnant here and then me having to go into a clinic and them getting to rape me, getting to shove a probe into me because it's mandated by Texas law is unbearable for us. It's unbearable. I also need health care. I haven't had health care for 5 years. Organizing gigs, grassroots politics, that doesn't pay well. You don't get benefits
right
with that. I desperately need health care. I need regular checkups. And New York has accepted federal expansion of Medicaid. New York protects women's right to choose. I can relax on those issues in New York. I'm not going to lie and say that my partner and I haven't discussed that maybe plans might have to change, that if I get a convincing enough argument that I can finally get a place at a table to affect how we organize in Texas, that I wouldn't consider staying here. But that opportunity would have to present itself. I can't fall behind a party structure that's been failing for 30 years here, you know? They've excluded me. And now that I've shown them that people are looking for pushback, they are looking for anger, they don't want to play the decorum game, they're a little bit more open. So we'll see what happens. But I also have some very best friends in New York, and it's an amazing city. And while I'm still young and don't have kids, I'd kind of like the experience to live there.
Yeah, well, I mean, if you do end up making it to New York, we've got to have you in. We rarely have people in studio, mostly as a function of our studio not being terribly fancy. But we'd love to have you in when you hit New York. I assume you're going to continue being politically active in this state. There's a lot of we don't have necessarily the same issue set, but there's a lot to be done here.
Oh, yeah. New York's got plenty of problems. I mean, don't get me wrong. New York is the model for the serious income inequality that defines this country at the moment. You know, there's all kinds of issues. The police state in New York, you know, the fact that, you guys have such large, broad, expansive surveillance. If I was in New York, I'd really want to look at, you know, helping low-income communities, women's prison reform, and working, you know, to understand why we need as many police as we do in New York City. So instead of Rick Perry, I think I'd be looking more towards people like Ray Kelly to critique once I got to New York.
And just give me a sense. Are your parents politically active? I mean, I have an 8-year-old daughter.
You want to know how someone like me came out of Texas?
Well, I know. I just want to know how someone like you came out of anywhere, frankly. But yeah, I got an 8-year-old daughter, and I would be terribly excited if she was as well spoken and as well informed in politics as you are at age 28.
Well, when I was 3 years old, my mom would set me in front of C-SPAN, and I would sit there and point at the TV and shake my fingers at it. And I don't know what she thought I was doing, but apparently I was actually engaging in policy debates at that young of an age with the Reagan Congresses. And then my parents were actually opposites. My dad, I think, if you could even describe him, tomorrow will be 12 days that he's passed. He's no longer with us.
I'm sorry to hear
12
that.
Years that he's passed. I'm sorry. He was kind of a conservative libertarian almost. He was very much a Texan before you could describe him in any other way, as like a middle-aged man or an Arab American. Like, he was very much a conservative libertarian. My mom, on the other hand, is very much what you describe as a progressive, a liberal. And as I was growing up, Sunday mornings were about watching my parents basically have a cool, like, playful, sometimes not so playful, fight about Meet the Press. They would watch Meet the Press in front of us, tussle over every issue in Bill Clinton, and we would get to watch. You know, political discourse and disagreement was okay in our house, and that was a huge part of how my brother and I got to be the way we are.
And give me a sense. I also wanted to, you know, one thing that strikes me, yesterday we played your testimony, and then we followed it up, something that was unrelated, a journalist, an independent journalist, confronting some NSA recruiters at a language program that she was attending. And
I referenced that in an article with the Daily Dot, actually. It's a huge deal, and it's one of the only ways, it's one of the best ways that social media is kind of prevailing over mainstream news and independent journalism is prevailing. And it's a great idea of people with access and privilege turning it on its head. You know, it's easy to just accept the NSA gig, you know, accept the intelligence gig, but to go in there and try and find out what's happening is a really brave sacrifice of privilege, and it's what's necessary at this time. People working 2 and 3 jobs and being afraid to become one of, you know, the 18 million unemployed people in this country, they can't go to state hearings. They can't infiltrate meetings. So we need more of that.
Yeah, I mean, it strikes me that we're seeing more of it. I mean, you know, and I think about what's happening in North Carolina right now, where each week we have tens, if not hundreds sometimes, people getting arrested, fighting back about what's happening in North Carolina. There just seems to be, and perhaps maybe some of this is coming out of the wake of Occupy in some respects, as people get training and move into other areas or are simply inspired by it. But it seems to me that there's just a heightened level of direct activism we're seeing in this country.
I definitely agree that people have begun to realize that I have the power. I can be a witness. I don't have to wait for a party to lead me somewhere. And you're right. You know, I was a part of Occupy Houston. I was in a part of a network with a lot of Occupy activists. And, you know, Occupy fizzled when it fizzled. But you're absolutely correct. People linked up. People got training. People got skills. And people got roughed up by the intelligence, you know, establishment. And people got roughed up by the police. And it does kind of bring back to mind, like, we might be actually nearing towards that civil era type moment. You know, it took white kids going down south, getting their heads busted on TV for people to say, wow, I've got to get in there and actually exercise the political pressure I can bear. And so what we're seeing right now is people risking, you know, serious blacklisting, violence, losing their jobs while being arrested like they do on the Moral Mondays, all kinds of things. People are really putting themselves out there to desperately, you know, grasp at not a politician's attention, but their own people, their fellow people's attention, and that's powerful.
Yeah, it is, Sarah. And I just want to tell you, thank you for your work. Thank you for coming on. And you're just, I think that moment, that 3-minute clip provides just a tremendous amount of inspiration for people around the country. But just your passion and your work in general, I think, does the same. And really appreciate you taking the time to come talk us today. And certainly, please stay in touch. And even more so if you get to New York, we'd love to have you in. And anything we can do to help you find some work up in New York, I think you probably won't need our help, would be my guess. But please stay in touch.
I will, Sam, and thanks for always staying committed to trying to find a way to get people that need to hear you. We really appreciate it.
All right, thank you, Sarah. All right, folks, we're going to take a quick break, and we're going to run this interview I did with Dan Cantor of the Working Families Party. We did this interview about 3 weeks ago at Netroots Nation. About 3 weeks ago now, I think. Dan is talking about a bill, and this is particularly relevant on a day where the Senate has supposedly come to a deal on student loans, a deal that, frankly, I don't think is very good, perhaps better than the status quo. But in Oregon, the Working Families Party was part of a coalition pushing a plan called Pay It Forward, Pay It Back. Dan will mention it, but you should know as you're listening to this that this passed the Oregon State Senate on Monday. It had already been approved by the House, and I think the legislature will decide in 2015 whether to implement the pilot, but I think we're looking like it's going to happen. Here's that interview I did at Netroots Nation a couple of weeks ago with Dan Cantor from the Working Families Party. I am at Netroots Nation 2013. With me now is Dan Cantor. He is the executive director of the Working Families Party, a third party that is on the ballot in several states across the country, often where there is fusion voting, where a ticket can be endorsed by multiple parties.
Correct.
Dan, now I know you guys are in New York because I am in New York. I always vote on the Working Families Party ticket.
Where else
are you?
Party exists in New York, Connecticut. Working Families Organization, which is also part of us, is in New Jersey, Maryland, Washington, D.C., Oregon, trying to get off the ground in Washington State and Illinois. We'll see. There's a big hunger, we think, for sort of sensible progressive politics that we represent.
Now, you're involved with a number of issues of that ilk. One in Oregon that you're working on in terms of higher education.
Yes, it's a very exciting effort to establish a principle that used to exist of debt-free higher education. You know, as is well known at this point, a lot of students coming out of college or community college, or both four-year and community college with enormous debt burdens.
$1 trillion worth of debt.
Cumulatively. And the average, I think, is, you know, north of $25,000 now. And this has all sorts of bad cascading effects in terms of the kind of work people have to take, you know, just sort of psychologically and so on. So the question here is, this is in terms of new students coming in, trying to come up with a system that would enable them to not have to go into HOC. And so some people in Washington and Oregon have been promoting this notion of debt-free higher education in which tuition is free, and then you pay back after you graduate, 1.5% a year if you went to a two-year college, 3% a year if you went to a four-year college for 20 years. So if you do really, really well in life financially, you'll pay back more than someone who didn't. Our view is that's fine. That's a good thing. We're all in this together. That's kind of the working family's view of the world. And it has a lot of support. It's going to pass in Oregon in terms of legislation to begin the process of setting up a pilot project. This is a big deal. This is not some sort of, oh, let's pass a law, 6 months later we'll have completely reformed the system of higher education financing in America. So it's very exciting. Lots of students, parents, teachers, union people, activists, and so on.
So now you're anticipating this is going to pass in Oregon
in the next couple of weeks.
And it's going to be signed
tomorrow.
And it's going to be enacted.
I think on Monday the bill comes out of Ways and Means. We're very optimistic about that, and then believe it will. Yes, it will pass the legislature. It has bipartisan support at this point.
And so what are the 1, 2, 3% paybacks over the course of 20 years? How are they treated relative to the loans? In other words, are they
there's no loan? It's not like you have incurred a debt. You haven't borrowed money from anybody. You do have an obligation to pay your fair share. So we're saying after you graduate, or even if you don't graduate, not everybody who starts college finishes. You'll be obligated to pay some amount of the money you earn. So if you're unemployed and aren't making money, you're not paying.
What is the mechanism in which that money?
So how does it get collected?
Yes.
You know, out of your taxes. I mean, it requires some work to set it up. It's a new idea here in America. It's not a new idea in other countries. Australia has a system like this. You have to get it right. You don't want to let the state off the hook. You want to make sure the state continues to put adequate monies into public higher education.
Right.
This only obtains for the public higher education, not private schools.
I will say this. There's no doubt that this is not going to drive down the prices of education, I think, across the board, frankly, as long as the state schools continue to fund their education. Because one of the biggest drivers, as far as I can tell, of the cost of higher education is simply that more tuition is put on the backs of students.
Right.
At the lowest price point.
Right.
The cheapest colleges, the state colleges, now have raised their prices, so everybody else has. There's an upward pressure there.
Yeah, no, it's a terrible situation we're in. And this is by no means the only thing that needs to happen in this whole question of student debt. There was a great meeting here yesterday at Netroots Nation of a lot of people working on the student debt question, both the $1 trillion that is owed, that's a lot of money, by people who currently carry student debt, as well as what do we do about people going forward. This proposal in Oregon is about going forward, how do we get off of this cycle, but we also have to figure out what we're going to do about this enormous downward, pressure on people's lives, created by the current debt. You know, the smartest idea that I've heard is we ought to have the federal government do for students what they did for the banks. You should buy up the debt, lower the interest rate. People then still have to pay it back. There's no free lunch here, but we could have a much more sane system of finance.
We have lower interest rate, and frankly, I would like to go back. Let's end all Stafford loans and go back to offering free higher education via the states through federal funds.
Couldn't agree more.
But
we need some way stations on the trip to that effort, which is what the Oregon thing is, and so on.
We have a couple more minutes.
Sure.
Let's talk about what else the Working Families Party is doing. I know that there was a valiant attempt to change the way that we elect people or run campaigns, I should say, in New York State.
Sure. This was has been an ongoing effort for the last 2 or 3 years now. This legislative session just ended 2 days ago, or even 1 day ago in New York. We came close and failed. Very unhappy to report that. Two Democrats, in a sense, defected. And so this very ambitious effort to create a system of publicly financed elections in New York would have passed, did not pass. It passed one house, and then it lost by 2 votes when 2 Democrats who...
2 votes in the New York State Senate,
the upper
in the
house.
Senate.
In the upper house.
Wow.
So,
Democrats?
We're not done. One from Queens named Senator Malcolm Smith, and one from the Bronx, Senator Ruben Diaz Sr.
Oh, these guys. Okay.
They're not genuine progressives, shall we say.
Right.
We're not done. The governor has announced the formation of a commission to look into the whole question of money in politics in New York. This will, we believe, produce a huge amount of momentum for next season's session. But, you know, there's always a moment of we wish we had won.
Right.
And, we got to tell ourselves the truth here about that. We're a little deflated. On the other hand, you don't give up. Certainly the right doesn't give up. So, we're not about to either.
Okay. And just in general, just give people just a we got a minute left. Give me a broad packet so that people can get more information on the Working Families.
Yeah, you know, you go to the Working Families website. The core idea here is there's a huge market for sensible progressive politics. We've got to beat Republicans. We also have to challenge Democrats. That's our core idea, is that we have to make them better, yank them in a sensible, humane, progressive direction. If we do that, you know, we can save this country we love so much.
Dan Cantor, Executive Director of the Working Families Party, thank you so much for your time here today at Netroots Nation.
Thanks for having me.
All right, folks, that is the first half of our program has now ended. Well, I'm still talking, but it's coming to a close. Tomorrow's Casual Friday, Cliff Schechter will be with us. Matthew Film Guy will be back to give us a film recommendation. As we head into the better half of the program, we will talk about the student loan deal. We will talk about ENDA moving forward, the story of a 75-year-old, 63-year-old man who adopted his partner of 35 years because gay people in Pennsylvania are not allowed to have the same rights as straight people. We will talk about the Bradley Manning trial. This disaster in Quebec has taken more lives. And Harry Reid has put the nuclear option on the table for filibuster reform, I say with a grain of salt, a huge grain of salt. In fact, with a huge salt lick that I always keep by the side of my desk here as I do this program. All that and more, folks, you can support this program. Can make sure it continues by going to majority.fm and signing up as a member. It is painless, 33 cents a day. Again, if you cannot afford to become a member and want access to the better half of the program, send us an email at majorityreporters@gmail.com. We will make a deal with everyone, or anyone who finds themselves in that type of situation. You can also support this program by buying your Amazon crap at our Amazon link at majority.fm. You can give us a recommendation or review on iTunes. That is also very helpful. Helps spread the word. You can buy your coffee at justcoffee.coop, a fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate cooperatively owned business in Madison, Wisconsin. Coupon code MAJORITY gets 10% off. If you're a member of the program, you can be the first to get our iPhone app and be a beta tester. If you own a Roku, you can be a beta tester of our Roku app. What else? Donateyouraccount.com/majority.majority FM. You can be a part of this program in just a moment by calling us at 646-257-3920, 646-257-3920. You want to IM me? The IM machine is up. You can IM me at majority.fm, majority.fm at jabber.org. We'll be back in just a moment.